Well, I'm sure most of you are familiar with the trust exercise where you put your arms over your chest, standing on a chair, and you fall backwards, trusting that those behind you will catch you, will stop you from falling to the floor. Now, I don't recommend that you try this now, especially if you're in lockdown by yourself. After all, you can't catch yourself. You need someone else there. But the question is, who? Who can you trust to catch you? See, it's a good question to weigh up carefully. The person that you have or the people that you have behind you, can they be trusted to stop you from falling? Now, by that, I don't mean simply can you trust their character to not simply run off and leave you to hit the ground, but can you actually trust them to hold you up? And so, for example, any families with young children wanting to give this a go after the sermon, then please make sure that parents, you do the catching. Don't trust your children to catch you. That will not go very well. And I don't speak from any kind of experience. It just makes common sense. Whom can we trust? Where can we place our trust? Throughout this whole section in Isaiah, the Lord has sought to teach his people where they ought to put their trust. He has been calling them to put their trust in him and not in others. Now, those others that he's been speaking about so far have been other nations. Don't put your trust in Egypt, for example, as we saw last week in chapter 20. Don't trust those nations, because as strong as they may seem, they will all be brought low in the end. The Lord is the one instead who reigns. He is mighty and he will not fall. But here, in the second half of chapter 22, the oracles get focused right down to a personal level. Here, instead of simply nations or even cities being mentioned, it's individuals who are mentioned. Shebna and Eliakim. Now, these people are given as lessons to us, lessons in misplaced trust. And one of the reasons I think that we're given individuals here as examples is because when we're dealing only with nations, as we have done mostly up to this point, then that can all seem rather grand, but a little distant, irrelevant to you today. But what we see here in the second half of chapter 22 is that trust is something to be exercised at an individual level. You and I need to answer this question. Where are we to put our trust? Where are you to put your trust? Now, the first example that we have is that of Shebna. And what we are to learn from this, our first point this evening, is that we must not put our trust in ourselves, but instead we are to trust in the Lord alone. We must not put our trust in ourselves, we must trust in the Lord alone. Now, this is a lesson taught in the first half of chapter 22 as well, in the oracle about Jerusalem. They thought themselves successful in their own strength, rejoicing in their own handiwork, rather than looking to the Lord and coming to him and giving him thanks. And Shebna then is an individual representation of this same attitude. Now, Shebna was a man who held a high position in the royal court. He was set over the management of the king's household, a steward. A position of immense authority then, and immense power. In verses 17 and 18, we get some little details about his view of his own power, where the Lord mocks him for thinking himself to be a strong man with these glorious chariots that he has. Now, chariots are a sign of power here, not simply of wealth. Back then, they weren't simply for transport or for recreation. They were state-of-the-art pieces of military technology in the ancient world. As we find later in Isaiah as well, these chariots likely came from Egypt. They were the source of the riders and the chariots. And so perhaps Shebna has been someone who has sought to increase his power by being one of those people who put forward the idea of this alliance with Egypt, fighting for this alliance with Egypt. Perhaps a pivotal person in securing arms deals and alliances. These are things which the Lord has already spoken against in Isaiah so far. The nation were not to look to other nations. Judah were not to look to Egypt for their strength. Shebna as well has not been looking to the Lord for his strength. But instead, he has been looking to the other nations and really to his own position, his own skill to make himself secure. He's looked to his glorious chariots. They are the power, the military might that he relies upon. And so he is filled then with this sense of power. He seems to go on to then seek to take this power and give it some sort of prominent permanence. He seeks to make his power secure and lasting through the construction of this grand tomb. In verses 15 and 16, Isaiah is commanded to go and tell Shebna off for all of this. He says, what have you to do here, and whom have you here that you have cut out here a tomb for yourself? You who cut out a tomb on the height and carve a dwelling for yourself in the rock. You see, back then there were areas that were reserved for the burials of the greatest amongst the Judeans. Places like the Silwan Necropolis. It was somewhere that was ideally meant for kings and their families, at least for the elite of the elite. With ornate gabled ceilings in these tombs and doorways that reached high above the surface. But it was likely here that Shebna carves out his tomb. As verse 16 says, cut out a tomb on the height with these high entrances in. Now, a fun sideline fact here, there is actually a stone, a lintel for a rock cut tomb from this area. Now in the British Museum, you can go and see it. And the inscription on it is attributed to the steward, a steward of King Hezekiah. Quite possibly, almost certainly, this Shebna. We can see where his tomb was. But he builds it in this place that he shouldn't really build it. Hence Isaiah's, what have you to do here? Basically saying, what do you think you're doing? Making your tomb here. Who do you think you are? But who Shebna thinks he is one of the elites. He's the strongest. He's the greatest. And he wants others. He wants others to see him that way too. See, his whole focus was on him. He is filled with pride, and he seeks to immortalize his power, his grandeur in stone, his final resting place secure in the rock. But all this trust in himself, all this pride is misplaced. You see, the Lord is the rock into which he should have buried himself. Only he can be relied upon. Shebna's own position and power can't fulfill his desire for safety and for permanence. And Shebna should have realized this. Sure, he had his powerful chariots, he had his alliances and his military might, but he knows that that won't last. He still feels the need to prepare a tomb. He knows that his power will run out soon enough. Now, he tries to offset his mortality with an elaborate and enduring grave, but he's still going to be in there dead, isn't he? And what's more than this, he can't even control where he finally lays his head. Whether he builds this tomb or not, he can't determine whether or not he's going to rest in it in the end. Isaiah is to go on and say this to him. Behold, the Lord will hurl you away violently, O you strong man. He will seize firm hold on you and whirl you round and round and throw you like a ball into a wide land. There you shall die, and there shall be your glorious chariots, you shame of your master's house. You see, the Lord is the one that he should have trusted in, because the Lord is the one in control of everything. The Lord is the sovereign one, not Shebna. The Lord is able then to send him away as easy as if he's picking up a ball and throwing it. And so he says that Shebna will be cast away. Perhaps he ends up getting carted off along with his chariots with some of the exiles that the Assyrians do eventually take in the end. Or perhaps he'll die in some battle with those same precious Egyptian weapons. But for Shebna, there will be no eternal grand resting place, no eternal monument to protect this mere man. In fact, this tomb, because we know where it is, it ended up being incorporated into an ordinary house. It ended up getting plastered over and used for some time as a cistern, and is now apparently a storage room. There was no security in his own strength. He should not have trusted in himself. Now we can all do the same. We can be just like Shebna. Though we may not be in the position that he was, with the kind of power that he had, we may not end up being prime minister or a CEO of a major corporation. We might not be a multi-billionaire. We may not have the same sort of power that Shebna wielded, may not have that, but we can still do the same thing. We can look to our own hands and say, save me. I must secure my future. I need to make safe my legacy. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to focus in. I'm going to study this. And then from that, I'm going to go on and it's going to lead on to this job with this paycheck and this title and this reputation and prestige. And then with that paycheck, I'm going to go and I'm going to buy this kind of house. And along the way, I'm going to get this kind of spouse. And we'll have this many children, of course. And they'll have this kind of personality, though that never works out, does it? And we're going to give them this kind of education, which will lead on to them having this kind of job. And I'll be able to, in my old age, just enjoy the reputation that I glean through them. That legacy will then pass on and on and on. Now, you may not have planned out all of those things in detail, but most of us will at least look to some of those things or something else that we feel that we can achieve, that we must achieve in our own might in order to secure our future, to secure our hope, to save ourselves, to make us whole. But a lesson that many have learnt in this year, in 2020 so far, is that we cannot secure our future. We are not in control. We don't know what tomorrow brings. That's what we read in the book of James. It says, come now, you who say today or tomorrow we will go into such and such a town and spend a year there and trade and make a profit. Yet you do not know what tomorrow will bring. What is your life? For you are a mist that appears for a little time and then vanishes. See, we can't secure ourselves. We cannot put our trust in ourselves. We cannot trust ourselves to save ourselves. That would be as foolish as you standing on a chair and falling back with no one behind you, hoping that you can get round fast enough to lift yourself up. It does not work. So then, if we can't trust ourselves, if we can't look to ourselves to make ourselves secure, whom can we trust? Where can we place our trust? Well, if not ourselves, then we've got to look to another, haven't we? Perhaps We don't look to a Shebna. We don't look to ourselves. Perhaps we need to look to an Eliakim instead. You see, in verses 20 to 24, or perhaps 25, but definitely 20 to 24, we have this person, Eliakim. And he seems to be set in contrast with Shebna. The Lord will raise him up to take the position of Shebna. It will take his position and his responsibilities. Verse 21, I will clothe him with your robe and will bind your sash on him and will commit your authority to his hand. Verse 22, he's given the key to the royal house, the authority to open and shut, the authority basically to make decisions, something which no doubt the steward would have done before him. And where Shebna then, in that same position, was ashamed to his master's house, Eliakim is set up as this contrast that he will be, in verse 23, a throne of honour to his father's house. You see, Eliakim and Shebna are not alike. Eliakim is not self-focused, it seems. He's not there building a tomb to his own honour. Instead, others are able to depend on him for their own good. In verse 21, it says that he will be a father to the inhabitants of Jerusalem and to the house of Judah. He's going to be a father, caring for their needs. And as the Lord secures him, like a peg in a secure place, people feel that he is able to handle all sorts of situations. It says, they will hang on him the whole honour of his father's house, the offspring and issue, every small vessel, from the cups to all the flagons. Even the small vessels, the cups and flagons, they're all hung on him. Everything is made to depend on him. And so we recognise that we shouldn't trust ourselves. We shouldn't be a Shebna. We perhaps realise that we shouldn't trust in self-seeking people like Shebna either. We shouldn't look to Shebnas. And so we think, well, we need to look to an Eliakim then, right? We need to find one and look to him or her. Someone that the Lord raises up, dependable, godly men and women, and place our trust, our hope in them. That's what we can be made to think perhaps when we read through this and we see this contrast. But we then have a really big problem when we get to verse 25. As we read this, in that day, declares the Lord of hosts, the peg that was fastened in a secure place will give way, and it will be cut down and fall, and the load that was on it will be cut off, for the Lord has spoken. So this peg, this Eliakim, gives way, falls and fails, and everything comes crashing down. And we can read through and think, why? What hope is there then? If we can't lay our hope on the people that God raises up, then where is our hope? How can they give way and fail? Why would the Lord cut them down? All these questions can be going through us. And I think that as we look at this, what we see is that the issue isn't really with Eliakim himself. The issue is with everyone else. See, the Lord raises him up, a peg in a secure place, but that does not mean that he is meant to handle the burden of all their hope, to take everything upon himself. And so this then is our second point. We must not put all our trust in other human beings. Trust in the Lord alone. You see, the people aren't really meant to look to Eliakim for all their hope, as the source of their security. No, he, as a human being, is not strong enough. However secure he seems, he's not designed to bear all that weight. It's like, again, with that trust exercise, it's like looking to that toddler behind you with their arms outstretched and their legs in a good stance and then thinking, oh, that's great. I'm going to now put my arms across my chest, close my eyes and fall back, trusting that they'll be able to catch me, to bear me up. It's foolish. No, the lesson that the Lord has been teaching throughout this section of Isaiah, and here too with Eliakim, is that there is no replacement for the Lord God himself. No replacement at all. He must always and forever be the ground of our hope. So yes, he raises people up. Yes, he uses others to be a great help to us. He may, in our own day, as we think about how this applies to us, he may raise up people and place them in positions of power. Perhaps he raises up politicians to fulfill some sort of purpose. But at no point are we to look to them as though they're messiahs, come to set all things straight. No, they won't build for us a utopia. We can't look to them to be perfect. And I'm honestly not making any specific references to anything that's in our news currently. But we know this, don't we, that they will always make mistakes. But it's still something that we're tempted to do, isn't it? Every time that an election rolls around, we get the leaflets through the door and we think, this person, this group, this party will save us. We need to rely on them and we need to put all our hope on them, to trust in their every decision. And then all who oppose them, for any mistakes that they might actually be making, they become our mortal enemies. But no, they cannot bear that weight. They should not have to bear that weight. They're not meant to. They are frail and imperfect human beings, and they will always get plenty wrong. And the good that they do achieve, that may not last forever anyway. Yes, we give thanks to God for the work that he does through them, for those that he raises up. But we always are to fix our eyes on the Lord himself and on him alone, for what he's going to then do next, who he will raise up next, what he will do. Or perhaps it's not politicians. We may look instead to those godly men and women that the Lord raises up in order to build up our faith. But then he always takes them away after a time, doesn't he? After all, he gave the apostles, but then he took them away. He gave the church fathers, but now they're gone. There have been good godly teachers throughout the ages. They have lived and they have taught, and then they have gone. Some perhaps have even been a part of our own lives. Perhaps godly parents who taught you many of the things that you know about Christ. Brothers and sisters and friends who have drawn alongside you and shared with you the good news of Jesus Christ. Challenged you when they've seen you going astray. Encouraged you in your walk with Christ. And perhaps there are even godly pastors or teachers or counselors in your lives. Some may have been taken away already. Some may still be with us now. But none of them, not one of them, can be the foundation for our faith. After all, they may fail and mess up. They may fall into sin. And if our faith, if our hope is reliant on them, then they'll take that along with them as they fall. Or even if they don't fall, even if they have always been an encouragement to you, well, what will happen to them will be the same that has happened to all of God's people. They will all eventually be called home to him. The Lord eventually takes them away. And so your faith this evening, our faith, cannot be based on them. Their task is only to be a sign pointing us to the source, the bedrock, the foundation, the Lord himself. That safe and sure hope. The one who fastened those people securely for a time. And can, this one who can and will secure you and your future for all eternity if you put your hope and your trust securely in him.